Hello and welcome to the Pratfalls Podcast, a show that features conversations with people who make creative stuff about how all that work intersects with the rest of their lives. I'm your host, Levi Weinhake, and you can find me on Twitter at ThatLevi. This episode features my conversation with Eric Westra. Eric is an event producer. He creates experiences and works with a lot of amazing people to do all kinds of really interesting things. And I will get into that in just a moment. A few bits of business. This show is part of the Noise Picnic Podcasting Network. Go to noisepicnic.com for other great shows, all based in the Twin Cities. And of course, you can always rate and review Pratfalls Podcast on iTunes, and that really helps. Do it! Do it now! Go! All right, let's get to my conversation with Eric Westra about making cool events happen and trying to be a good person. Here we go.
So I'm talking today to Eric Westra.
Yes.
And, hi, Eric.
Hi.
Sometimes I try to describe people's work, but I want you to say what your work is, because I don't know.
That's totally fine.
I don't know how to
sometimes
say it.
Sometimes I don't really even know.
Yeah, well, that's the joy.
How to explain it.
But on paper.
On paper, I am an event producer and consultant, is what I do. So I work with a number of different clients who want to put together an event, which could mean anything from like a small art show to a large conference. And yeah, that's about it.
So I want to talk a little bit about like how you got in sort of the path to that work.
Yeah.
Because it's, I don't, just finding a lot of people are like, when I grow up, I want to be an event planner.
Yes.
But also, it feels like...
I don't even think there's very many event planners who are like, I want to be an event planner. But
right. I don't know. That you probably would know people. I bet you have some people who are like, oh, that sounds cool. And
then yeah,
like,
totally.
It's mostly emailing.
Yes. And you also have me on a really good, like, stressed out day. So
yes,
I'm going to be like, you know, you'll get the seedy underbelly of the events world.
If you could just vent, that would be ideal.
Perfect.
But I imagine, because you're like self-employed, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's essentially sort of contract work type stuff. But you also have to work with a bunch of different vendors, I would imagine, depending on scope and scale of the events. And I'm guessing sometimes it's your responsibility. It's sometimes you connecting the person or organization you're with to vendors.
Yeah, I would say mostly it is me working with those vendors. The place that I fit really well is when people have a great idea or an audience or an event that they want to either try to start or need, or it has grown and they don't have a staff, is that they'll hire somebody like me to come in and just handle all of the logistics that they either don't want to handle or don't know where to start with that. So there's a lot of people who have really great contacts for, like, I have speakers and I know my audience really well, and I know my, you know, brand or my industry really well, and so I know who I want to speak at my conference, and I know like how many days it's going to be and all of these types of things. But when it comes to how do I make sure that there is a kosher meal for somebody, or how do we get tables?
It's like logistics and administrative.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And like, you probably have to deal with some venue issues all the time.
Yeah, I try to sort of pitch it as you worry about making the content and the presentation of your event the best it can be, and don't worry about all the other stuff. I'll worry about that.
So one of the reasons there's a bunch of reasons I wanted to talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
Some is just because of the nature of the events that at least I know of that you've worked on. And then the people you know, like you, I know you know a lot of good people. It seems like your work, a lot of the people I talk to for the show are people who make a thing, artists, or they're making their own sort of creative project. But I also get to talk sometimes to folks who, as much of their work is about making their thing as it is sort of helping facilitate somebody else make or execute a thing. And it seems like I see a lot of that side of your work. So I'm curious about the creative fulfillment you get for that work, and how much you feel like you're making something, or are you helping someone else better understand what it is they're trying to make?
Yeah, I think so. My path to this line of work has been kind of circuitous and strange. And my background is in the arts, and I worked in the music industry for a long time.
Were you a musician?
I play music, but no, not like a professional musician by any means. But I was like head of promotion and publicity at First Avenue here when I used to live here. And then I moved to Chicago and worked at an awesome bar called The Empty Bottle, doing the same thing there. And so I've always, I worked in record stores all growing up. Like, I've always been a huge music and art fan. And there was like a certain point in time when I realized that I'm not necessarily the person who's going to be making art, right? But I have such a love for art and music that I want to be able to support and sustain it in some capacity. And so I involved myself in those scenes and those groups to be able to do that. And what I found was that there's a lot of people who are working within those worlds that don't necessarily have a lot of interest or ability to organize. And it was something that I was really good at doing. I like to say I'm pleasantly OCD, where I have always, for better or worse, been really good at organizing like conceptual information and turning an idea into something that you can actually execute, executing those ideas. And so it was a really good fit for me to be able to say, okay, well, I'm working with these bands or these artists, and we're going to put on this show, and so they're going to come play, I'll deal with all the rest, and have somebody who's got a budget and have somebody who's got a promotional plan and those sorts of things. And eventually I just kind of burned out on the hours and the terrible pay for that, and kind of bounced around between other jobs and kind of kept my one foot in those industries with just sort of friends and you know, going to shows and continuing to collect and appreciate art and music. And then I realized that a lot of the skills that I developed and had for that are what a lot of people who do events during the day have those same skills.
Who can still have like a family and a social life.
Yeah. My goal was to try to take on some of that as from an events standpoint during the day, and yet still keep enough time for me to be able to still do planning for the arts and music when I can. I've also always just sort of been somebody who, like, when I think of the things that I create, I think that I create them in a curatorial way, and I'm really good at bringing people together and bringing the right people into the right project, and then then helping them sort of make something happen with it. And so I've always had like little projects going on the side. I started a magazine with, I think it was like 12 years ago, with Dan and Michael from Aesthetic Apparatus.
Those guys are great.
Yeah, so we started this magazine called Ladies and Gentlemen, or LagMag, and it was really just kind of like this idea that we had where I wanted to bring together all these different musicians and writers and journalists.
And those two have been making poster art for amazing bands for
And that's actually how I met them, is I commissioned their first posters when they moved here. I was the guy who was doing that at First Avenue. So they made their first posters for me at First Avenue.
Cool.
And we've just been friends ever since. So we made like this 12 by 12 magazine that was like screen printed cover, and it came with a record, and it was just kind of this thing where it was like getting all this really interesting content and cool stuff together, and then just sort of we made something that we wanted, you know, to bring everybody together and be like, hey, this is this awesome thing that we want all of our friends to work on. And then we did it, and it was super fun. So I have to have something like that going on all the time, some sort of creative interaction as a side project if it's not happening within my actual work. So I think that maybe that in a roundabout way answered your question, but it probably didn't.
No, I just said, what's your name? One thing I'm really curious about, one thing that resonates with what you talked about, is I remember I've been producing theater for like the last 6 years. I was mostly just writing, performing, and I still do that, but feeling much more a part of the how to make the thing happen. And for me, when I noticed a shift was how much I was thinking about the audience experience of the thing, from where would they park to how would they get in the room, what would it feel like, what would music would play, how the lighting affects, you know, like letting people not bring what they don't want to bring into that space before they see a show, which people who make events think about that stuff, but until you see it not work right, I don't think you're very aware of it, because it just seems like magic. You don't notice it unless something goes wrong. But then it really started mattering to me, and then there became this joy in seeing people appreciate that and not even know they're appreciating it. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious if you can remember, even when you were a teenager, and maybe it was into being into music, a time when you sort of created experiences for somebody or some group of people, and it, like, you noticing that feeling of, I'm giving them this experience, and I, you know, like a mixtape even, I think, does that kind of thing.
Totally.
But I'm curious if you have that in your brain.
Yeah, I mean, people of a certain age, we all ate our mixtapes.
I think probably pretty dated now, too.
Yeah, I mean, I think that magazine that I was talking about, it wasn't when I was necessarily very young, but it was the first time that I felt like I really pulled together a very disparate group of artists and writers and musicians, and in a way used the contacts that I had developed throughout my years working in those things to create something that made a lot of people really excited. And made an experience for those people. And the magazine itself was meant to be an experience that you had to, like, take the record out and put it on. And, you know, this was, like, 2001. So, like, the big vinyl resurgence hadn't quite kicked in.
No, that's a ways of...
And so people are like, why are you doing this? Like, why not just make a CD? It'd be way cheaper. I was like, well, that's just no fun. Like, we want you to stop. Sit down, page through this magazine, look at all the art, read the stuff, and listen to the music. And so that was sort of a way that I wanted to create an experience. And they, you know, with Dan and Michael, where we wanted to create experience that was like the type of experience we enjoy in our own free time, kind of thing. But I think something that you said about making events and sort of thinking about the audience, I think that that doesn't happen quite as much as you would like to think. And when
people thinking about the audience.
Yeah, I think that especially with event planning, there's a lot of form over function that takes place. And I didn't really realize it as much until I started going to a lot of conferences and seeing a lot of events that in a lot of weird ways didn't seem like they were thinking of the audience as, like, human beings that were there.
The lighting is wrong, the food timing is wrong.
Yeah, and, like, just, like, blasting a schedule together that has no breaks.
Yeah.
Or, like, only 10-minute breaks where people have to rush to get to and from. There's all these, like, little things that I think it's... I mean, anybody can sort of create a schedule and be like, well, the food will be over there, and you have this amount of time to do it. But to, like, stop and really think about what we as human beings need throughout a day, especially if you're going to try to have it be an educational day of a, like, a conference type event. You know, people need breaks. People need to, like, talk with their peers and have these hallway conversations and different things. And I think a lot of times people assume that you're like, well, we got to get as many speakers in during the day as possible because that's how they sell it to their boss, or, you know, it makes it look bigger and better to us. And I'm trying to shift that a little bit in a lot of the events that I work on to sort of change that focus to figuring out how to get people to take part as much as possible and set up a situation that allows them to relax and enjoy themselves so that they can participate. And I think that is starting to happen more and people are starting to think about that. And, you know, I think with a lot of other things, a lot of that comes from just sheer competition. There's, like, conferences for everything constantly now.
I want to hear sort of your... I'm guessing you have thoughts on that, because it does feel like I've been to a ton of conferences for all my different parts of my life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have non-profit-y kind of work life, and I have art life and other weird, like, social justice-y.
Mm-hmm.
And they all have their conference-type event, and there's some overlap. But it really feels more and more like a lot of people are just like, we should have a conference.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the theme of this conference is we wanted to have a conference.
Yeah.
Like, we know that makes us look like we're doing some work.
Mm-hmm.
Often those places I feel like nothing is happening at all. Like, it feels so unpleasant for me. But I also really love a well-orchestrated, brilliantly curated, thoughtful conference.
Yeah.
Makes connections that don't happen other places.
Yeah, and I think thoughtful is the key word there. I think that those are the different, like, you can tell when the people who put together a conference thought about all of the different aspects of it and thoughtfully curated the presentations and actually communicated with the speakers throughout the months leading up to it, saying,
so
like,
they're
hey,
engaged and connected.
Yeah, how is your, not even just like, hey, remember to book your flight, but like, hey, I'd love to talk about your
presentation. Or please tweet about it so more people come. Like,
yeah. Right. And to more kind of say, like, do you want to talk through how your talk is coming together? Like, yeah. You know, because you are the person who, I mean, it's your audience, right? It's their audience, you know, by definition, because they're going to be talking to them. But it's your audience. You're bringing these people together to see the people that you invited to speak at these things. And you should take... It shouldn't be a hands-off process when you're working with your speakers. It shouldn't be a hands-off process when you're working with your attendees either. It's, I think that putting that time in, and that's when you see those events that are great. I think that a lot of people are doing events now because theoretically on paper, they're money-making thing.
Yeah, what is the reality of a cost of a... I mean, you know, 1,000-person event, or
it depends so much on like what level you want to do things at, like even from like a box lunch to a buffet lunch, and who your caterer. I mean, you can swing things so much.
Yeah,
it's more like I think with a lot of things when you start with the conversation of hey, how can we make money? Let's have a conference.
Yeah,
how can we make money? Let's start a record label. How can we make money? Let's make this app. Like. 99% of those things that start that way, I don't think work out. It's more about like, okay, we have a need, or there's an audience need, or there's this is missing in this community, or this is missing in you know, this fills a need. And then determining, okay, how can we do this thoughtfully, and how can we do this and hopefully make money with it. But, you know, so many first-time conferences don't make money, and that's not a failure. That's just, you know, especially now in a very saturated...
I can't even imagine thinking of putting on a conference with the idea that it would be profitable. Like,
yeah.
I feel like it's like starting a restaurant. Like, you're going to lose money, maybe break even on your second or third time. Like,
yeah, I mean, sometimes you do, it turns out, you know, sometimes you do. So I moved here to start a conference with Christina Halverson, who owns a company here called Brain Traffic. A content strategy consultancy, mm-hmm. She wanted to start a content strategy conference, and there wasn't one in existence at that point that was specifically about content strategy and people who are doing that work and the sort of disparate fields that come together for that. So I moved here to start that, and I thought it was an interesting challenge, and we didn't have a lot of time to get it off the ground. And I mean, she was right. It was like an audience that needed a place to gather. And that first one sold out like 2 months in advance. Mm. And it was like completely out of the realm of the normal growth curve of a conference type thing. And then we just kept growing it, and we were doing like 4 or 5 a year around the world. It was crazy. And so sometimes that happens. Like, it's, you know, the audience, she had a really great audience and following, and we had a lot of really great people working with us, and just a lot of really smart professionals.
What's the status of that?
Still going
now? Yeah.
Yeah. I ended up leaving about a year and a half ago, almost 2 years ago, mainly because I wasn't enjoying it, but there was a lot more. We had a staff then, and it was like a lot more management of people and things. And I just don't like doing that.
Well, yeah, I could see part of doing what you do, where you're consulting with other folks, mm-hmm. is you get to work on new as mm-hmm. well as maintain stuff. And you also get to be iterative in the work. Mm-hmm. You know, there can be a thing where you're kind of just holding it down. Like, if your conference is going well and you're in your 10th year, you kind of become the drummer. Like, the whole job is to not notice any of the sort of stuff happening.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see how that gets less interesting, even if you're still, like, you care about the topic or the subject matter. Mm-hmm. And do you find yourself making moves around that? Like, how do you measure... I need to make, you know, there's financial considerations, like mm-hmm. some of why you do work is just to be able to pay for your life.
Yeah, I get bored easily. I mean, bored isn't really the right word.
What if you just got up and walked away right now?
Yeah. it's not really. I just there's this feeling that I get, where I feel like I'm just kind of treading water.
Do you fight it, or do you?
I fight
do you
it
have
for
to
a while.
Acknowledge it and go like, I'm not going to be able to force myself to be back interested.
Yeah, I mean,
again.
I fight it for a while to see if it's actually that feeling.
Yeah,
you know, because it's happened enough times now in my life where I'm like, okay, well, this is just kind of me being like, well, maybe it's time to start looking into something else.
Right.
And this time around, I had been doing I'd taken a freelance gig working with Open News, which is a grant-funded organization from the Knight Foundation and the Mozilla Foundation, and they were starting a conference called SourceCon for people who work in and around newsrooms and data journalism and things. And my friend Erin Kassane was part of that team, and she and I had worked together in the past on a magazine that we started called Contents Magazine. He was like, are you interested in this? And I said, absolutely. And I had so much fun doing it that I was like, okay, well, there's that piece that I was missing. You know, like that's how it felt when I was starting the confab bit. And so I was like, maybe I just need to be able to do a wider variety of things and have the freedom to jump around based on how I'm feeling about stuff. And, you know, Abby and I talked about it. And
that's your wife.
Yep, my wife Abby and I sat down and we had our first child like a year and a half previous to this, and we were like, can we give this a year and see how it goes and what, you know, financially needs to happen to make that work, and try to be very pragmatic about it and say, all right, we can do this, we need to hit these goals, and if we don't, I start looking for another job. Hmm. And if it does hit those goals, we give it another year and that kind of thing. And so, you know, I made the absolutely terrifying leap of being like, okay, successful conference that is still running very well. I'm going to just be on my way now and do this thing that I have only one client. And within like 2 weeks after leaving, just from contacts of people who I'd worked with, had told other people, like, hire this guy. I had 3 clients and then 4 clients. And now I'm booked into 2017 and I just hired a contractor for the first time.
Nice.
Like, and it's only been like a year and a half, and it's been awesome, and I really love it. And it sort of serves that purpose where, while I have a lot of different clients, what I'm doing for each of them is just different enough where it's a different type of challenge and a different type of work that allows me to sort of take on each of those. It's sort of like pushes those different buttons for me that I can be like, okay, well, today I'd rather be working on something a little bit more creative. And, you know, I have an event that I work on that's with comedians and podcasters that is just like,
yeah,
that one for me. And, you know, and then there's other ones that are a little bit more just tightly logistical,
yeah,
kind of thing. So
are you aware of the sort of pressures? You know, I have a day job right now, but the past year prior, I was freelance, predominantly writing. And there's parts I loved, parts I felt very lonely. Like, I'm pretty collaborative. It sounds like you have a lot of ways where you're still collaborating with people all the time.
Yeah.
But I also have this sort of enhanced, my wife's always made more money than me, and that's been great. Like, I love that.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, somehow, still, I was worried about if I was contributing enough in that way.
Yeah.
But I didn't like the way it was affecting the decisions I was making. Like, I was taking stuff I wasn't that interested in just because it had a dollar sign that was bigger than the other. Like, do you have to measure whether you're making enough on an individual thing? Like, how much does that affect, especially with you have 2 kids, right? Mm-hmm. And so, like, those are, like, visible, loud reminders that there's a need in the space, too?
Yeah, I learned pretty quick how I was screwing up my pricing and bidding of things. You know, one of the big differences is when you work for a company or a day job, there's not like, you're not tracking your every minute, you know, and it's not to say I track every minute now, but like if there's you work for the company, you have a paycheck, these are the projects you're working on.
Right.
And they need to be done by this day or whatever. Whereas now it's like, okay, well, if I, you know, get this job with this client and I have this contract, and I think it's going to take me 30 hours, but it takes 80 hours. Well, I just made...
You can't go talk to your manager about,
right,
my workload's off. I got to...
Exactly. And so I learned really quick that I needed to take a better care of sort of analyzing my time and seeing how that affects like being realistic about what I think I can handle and what I can't. I'm lucky to be in a situation where I've had enough clients where I haven't really worried about not having the money.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, I'm not like rolling around in cash upstairs or anything, but it's not
that's
something
gross, by the way. Too.
Yeah. Like, it's very dirty. It's more, I, the thing that I am struggling with more now is that idea of, let me back up for a second. So I grew up, my dad owned his own business my entire life.
What was the business?
He owned an audio video store in Rochester, Minnesota.
Did you get to like play with gear and all kinds of stuff?
Yeah. Yeah. So it was, you know, I saw his life, and he, you know, got to be his own boss, and he, you know, he worked in retail, so he had a schedule. But at the same time, like he would, you know, there's a flexibility there. And so I've always had that bug for me, and this is the first time I've like really jumped into it.
And he was dependent on himself too. Like there's a message there of
And so I also know what like those sort of like what those lean months look like, and especially when you're on a contract type situation, it's like, for instance, right now I am in the middle of, I think I told you when you got here, but I have 3 very large events in the next 4 weeks, and then a fourth 2 weeks after that. And that is not a good idea. And I've had to work a lot harder and a lot more and put in some crazy hours, and I hired a contractor, and like I'm still doing the work that I'm proud of. It's getting, you know, it's happening. But that was a direct result of me looking at things and saying, I don't want to turn away this work because it sounds interesting. It could be a long-term partner, and I'm fine now, but like I don't know what early 2017 is going to look like.
Right.
And so it's trying to make those decisions, less about like a month-to-month making sure that I have enough to pay the mortgage. Or
you're fostering a long-term relationship.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think what's interesting about my line of work is that it generally is long tail.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if somebody's hiring me to help them with logistics on a conference, we're generally talking about something that is at least 6 months, if not longer, away. Right. And so that's a lot easier for long-term financial planning as a someone who works for themselves than, say, someone whose projects are more like two-week, month-long projects where you're like, well, this month is great, but I don't see what's happening next month. So
that made me think of like a dozen things.
Mm-hmm.
See if I can hold any of them in my head at the same time. Because one of the things I'm really curious about, for your standard like musician or even like writer,
mm-hmm.
everyone's had the experience of, hey, can you come help be a part of this thing? I'm just not making money now, but I think someday. It's partially that exposure thing, but mm-hmm. I think there's layers, and there are like, oh, we're kind of friends, as well as there's some professional colleagueship here.
Mm-hmm.
I would imagine people knowing the work you do, and you know a bunch of people who aren't contracting you, but who are putting on big and small events, tiny, mm-hmm. but whatever, must ask for, it could start with, hey, do you have a suggestion of this person who can blank, and mm-hmm. then can easily turn into, you can't email me every day because I'm not working for you right now. Mm-hmm. So what do you do with that sort of stuff?
Yeah, I generally speaking, if someone just has a question or they're, you know, are wondering about this thing or another, I've always been very happy to share information and share knowledge with people. You know, if I have found a really good way of dealing with something, or I have found like 3 really great venues in a particular city, mm-hmm. and somebody asks me about it, like I don't consider those like trade secrets, even though, like, you know, it's work that I put in to find these places.
But that helps those venues too. Yeah, I mean,
yeah, and I've just found long term that helping people out is a better relationship, you know, builder over the, you know, like.
I would like everyone to write that down.
Yeah, that's never done me wrong. Like it's, you know, obviously there's a limit to it, and if so, I feel like somebody's like pushing it, then you know I pull back. Or just
have you had
like,
to do that?
A couple of times, and they totally understood.
Yeah.
You know, I was just kind of like, hey, you know, like I'm happy to keep helping you with this. Why don't we talk about like doing like a pack of 5 hours or something, consulting hours, and we can talk more about this. And it's sort of like just a, you know, a light way of being like, you're taking up a lot of my time.
So, yeah.
But
I'll let you keep answering that, but I want to add another layer to.
You need some advice for your event.
Yeah, yeah. I would love that if that's it. So I have a conference. It's in a month. Can you do all the things?
Yeah.
I do want to know about that when you have someone come and they clearly don't have enough time to do what they want to do and how you gently tell them, mm-hmm. like, you've ruined everything. But I have a tendency to sort of absorb someone else's energy, and then I get really excited about their mm-hmm. thing, and I can lose sight of, like, well, this isn't my project.
Yeah.
And you're working on stuff you actually care about. Like, mm-hmm. you know, I know of some of the conference-y things you're connected to are actual things you're also engaged in the content. You yeah. know, like you like the things that are mm-hmm. being made around those things. So is there a danger, or is it all just great to be working on helping someone make their thing happen, but then it's not really your thing at the end of the day? Like,
I feel like that's in a lot of ways always been the types of jobs I've had mm-hmm. where, like, I'm sort of behind the scenes and it's not like the publicly thanked version of
yeah.
that kind of thing, and that doesn't really bother
me. You don't
me
have either. To tell. You know, I'm the guy behind the...
Yeah, no.
Because if you'd like to now, you can just list every...
These are all the great things I've done and not gotten credit for.
I want you to just... every Super Bowl halftime show.
Yep. It sort of goes back to that, like, helping people thing where my primary concern from a day-to-day standpoint, professionally, at this point, is being happy with the work I'm doing, being proud of the people I'm working with and the projects I'm working on, and, like, having them go well and having that person either say, let's work on this again together next year, or I need to introduce you to this person who wants something to be done. There's that thing where if something grows and grows and grows, there's going to be a point where either they'll say, like, well, do you want to be doing this full time with us? No, because that's, you know, just not, I don't want. So there's been one instance in particular where they were like, is there any way that you would be interested in a staff job? I was just like, I'm not really, you know, but thank you. And that means a lot to be asked that. But I guess the answer is no. Like, I am completely, as long as I'm working on something that I feel really good about, working with people I'm excited to work with, and put in and creating something that makes other people feel really good, that's great. And yeah, I'm happy with that.
So maybe somewhat connected. When you attend a thing mm-hmm. that you had no part in doing, are you able to be an attendee and
no.
not?
No.
Breakdown it, like, what is that like for you?
That's happened to me for so many, like, so for instance, when I was working at the Empty Bottle, there's a lot of stuff that it was a very small bar, and there were like three of us who worked in the upstairs doing the booking and promotion and settling and stuff, and then there was a bar staff, bartenders, and then there's people who like worked, and like there were nights where I would work the door and then I would also work production and
just fill in holes.
Yeah. Or just making sure that bands are happy and these things are going well. And so it got to a point where especially if I was at a show at the Bottle and even after I stopped working there, like I'd be standing there and I'd be like, oh man, that is going to be a problem. You know, like, or like I can hear that, like, or see that the guitar player is like trying to get the sound person's attention and the guy's not paying attention, like, and those just take me right out of the moment. Mm-hmm. And the same thing happens at events where I'm just like, oh, this could have been so easy to fix and you didn't fix it. And so I, you know,
do you give feedback
if asked?
Yeah,
you know,
you won't go up and
no,
hey,
yeah,
pardon me,
yeah here's my card.
Yeah
I've noticed these 12 things you did.
Yeah, it's rarely well received.
Yeah,
even though it's often so needed.
Yeah,
of just,
and it's actually been kind of interesting lately that I don't. When I was with Brain Trafficking at Confab, I went to a lot more events to sort of get a feel for the competition in that arena, and I don't do that as much anymore because I'm traveling so much for work. I thought I was going to have like a bunch of local clients, and it was going to be like, and a few not local clients, but I have zero local clients. Mm. And I'm like,
you burn so many bridges.
Yeah,
in town.
Exactly. I was like, I can't figure it out. And I'm traveling so much right now, and my wife travels a lot for work, and we now have two children, and it's a lot of solo parent time.
And they're little, right? You have a 3-year-old
and a 3-month-old. Yeah. And so I just can't fill in the extra time with like checking out these other conferences and things, even though in some ways it would be helpful to do.
So,
well, so with the travel, like you mentioned, your dad having his own store, mm-hmm. and you seeing that as mm-hmm. a there's an independence there, mm-hmm. and I can imagine having your own. I know having your own business can mean you can time shift and be a present parent mm-hmm. at times when it may be more difficult for people with a more typical work yep. schedule. But also, you're traveling. So, is there like tension for you of when you're home, you're thinking about the work things that need to be getting done, and when you're off, you're thinking about, well, I'm not yeah. being a good dad right now, even though like it all informs one another. And
yeah, I mean, I think
to get your inner demons, like what. Yeah.
I think it's impossible not to, you know, I think it's just human nature to constantly be sort of like, okay, well, you know, especially if there's a bunch of stuff that needs to happen by a certain day or whatever. But I've made so a lot of my clients are on the West Coast, and I've made it very clear that at 3 o'clock their time, I'm done for the day. You know, I either Abby or I will pick up, our kids at, daycare at 5 o'clock, and neither of us work, and if we have work to do, it happens after they go to bed.
And you stick to that pretty
we do yeah and it's especially with the fact that we both travel, like we don't ever want it to seem like, oh, daddy's working again or that kind of thing, you know. And so even though it is sometimes I'm like, oh, I could get so much done if I just like worked up until 10 o'clock tonight.
Yeah.
Like from 6 o'clock. Like I just need like 5 hours to just get some
stuff.
Yeah,
sometimes
done.
You're hitting a nice groove of getting actual stuff
yeah,
done.
Yeah, but it's more important to me to not do that. So I end up in these situations where, like right now, like at 5 o'clock, I'm going to go pick them up, and then they're going to go to bed at 8, and then I'm going to start working. And then I'll end up working late until, of course, the baby wakes up at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
We'll see what happens. But one of the reasons that I decided to go out on my own was that flexibility for being able to be here and being with my family. And when I have to travel and like physically can't be, it makes that time even more important. And so that's something I've been I stick to it in that, for better or worse from a work standpoint, but I never regret it. You know?
Yeah.
That's our time. So
that's, I mean, that's really impressive.
Yeah.
And like I both am impressed and then feel a little bad. You say that as a father of one 10-year-old who like has spent so many evenings in the green room of the theater where I'm rehearsing or working on something. And
yeah.
Like,
but I feel like
she loves that. It becomes part of the sort of the family circus.
Yeah, and I think that's
I don't
a
mean
different
the comic strip family circus.
Yes, because that would be terrible.
Yeah, she does make dotted lines when she walks.
You should have that checked out.
It's fine.
I feel like that's a different sort of thing where
I'm not having you reassure me now, Eric. What?
No, but really, I think that so when the time comes that Freya, my oldest daughter, is old enough to travel without it being a huge headache for both of us, I want her to be able to come with me on some of these trips.
Yeah, that'd be
and
super
see,
cool.
See that stuff. And so, it's just that the work that I end up doing is sitting at my computer upstairs, and that's the thing that I refuse to do.
You don't make her come stare at that?
Yeah. You know, we even have, like, these little rules where, like, if not both Abby and I can't be on our phones at the same time if a kid is in the room. You know,
I like
because
that
the last
rule.
Thing I ever want is for, like, her to look like want our kids to look up and be like both mom and dad are like this.
Yeah.
And so like
even if it's pictures of the
yeah,
kids.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm just looking at pictures of you. I know you're right there. But,
yeah. You were different.
Yeah,
then.
So there's just like certain things like that I don't want to have be part of their childhood.
Yeah.
And I don't want it to be like I'm okay with, you know, mommy and daddy go on trips a lot for work, and eventually they're going to be able to take advantage of that too. And we do, because Abby and I both work from home, because her company is still in Chicago where we moved here from, so she works remote. We can sometimes go on trips with each other and just work from wherever that is. We were able to do that a lot more before the kids, but it's something that we can still do. So there's been like, you know, vacations and things and work things that have been like, well, one of us is actually working, but we're all going to go. And so there's a flexibility there that comes with that. And so I think that if that balance can be maintained, I'm okay with that. Like, I like the idea that she knows that, you know, she'll grow up knowing that if I'm still doing this, you know, that I took a risk and tried this out, and I'm trying to make it work, and that's exciting to me in the same way that my dad's business was exciting to me.
So you're, to me, like the thread of all the projects you do, and even like the booking music, like I think the most successful music bookers understand the relationship piece. It's not just we need this band on this night at this time because that's when the most audience, like that's fine, but it's about you even giving that band a good experience and an audience. So all of the, it feels like all your work is about maintaining human relationships. I mean, that's true for a lot of us, but like that seems really core to how you talk about it. So I'm curious if you are you aware of how that impacted how you view the relationships you have, even if they're your personal relationships, the way that it's not like you're being manipulative, but you see the value of sort of treating people well.
Yeah, I had a, so I do this thing with Kate O'Reilly called Solo Team, which was basically just our attempt to try to get people who work for themselves.
Because you guys are both like freelancers who also really connect to a lot of people.
Yeah, and we wanted to get people in a room so that they could like bounce ideas off people when they maybe don't get to be around other people during the day, and just kind of see, it was an experiment, just kind of see what happened. And
you did it after I bailed on being solo.
Yeah,
it was too late for me.
and Dan Ibarra, previously discussed from Aesthetic Apparatus, was sort of one of our guest speakers one time, and he was talking about, and I'm just going to completely murder this.
He's a good at, he speaks in complete sentences really well.
He does. And he was sort of talking about the difference between networking and like building a relationship. And networking to him is more what can that person do for me, and building a relationship is more like what how can we work with each other, or how can, like, let's get to know each other and see, you know, kind of thing. And if something good comes of it, then great, but it's not like your initial thought process isn't like, oh, I need to know that person because that person does these things and I can meet this other person or whatever. And I know it's, I feel like I keep coming back to this, and it sounds so hokey, but
you're just on brand. That's all it is.
Yeah. It's, I am genuinely interested in people and what people are doing and why they're doing it. And I like to have conversations with people about that. And if I can help people, why not help people? And whether that's something that's just like, oh yeah, I know a person you should talk to about it. You're really interested in X? Well, let me introduce you to this person. And even if it's just sending an email and the two of them never talk, you know, like I feel like I did my part. It's like trying to build that sort of connection. And that kind of thing never comes back to like bite you, I don't think. At least not yet for me. And
I would imagine that scenario though, where you created a connection and just took a bad turn.
Yeah, things went awry. I just think that I like meeting people. I like talking to people, and I like, it's just, I'm a people person. But really, it's.
Do you feel like that was modeled for you, like when you were?
I do. My dad was definitely like a local businessman guy who just kind of knew everybody, and he taught me a lot about that sort of hard work and honesty as like the tenets of his, like going the extra mile as the tenets of his sort of business for people. It was more of a, you know, there's a reason that somebody would prefer to work. There are agencies and there are people who have a lot more experience than me and a lot more manpower than me. And, you know, if people are hiring me to do this, it's because they want to work with me. And so that's always been kind of interesting to me, where like even my sort of website branding is more of just like a, I'm Eric. Hi.
Yeah. You don't have much, you know, bells and whistles.
Yeah. And I don't need it, because what I want to do is have a conversation with those people and say like, well, here's what I do and here's why I do it. And it's more saying like, you get to work with me and this is why you would want to work with me, and if you're looking for X, Y, and Z, that's not really what I do, and here are a couple of people I think you could talk to, or a couple of companies you could reach out to. And so I think that that's been really cool, because that piece that I learned from my dad, who You know, you could always go buy a stereo at, you know, Best Buy or whatever, right? But he had like a small shop that people would like come in and ask, and if something went wrong with it and he was free and it was like 9 p.m., he'd like go over to their house and fix it for him, kind of thing. And there was that, like, people choose to work with a small business for a reason. And the idea is figuring out how to do the quality work that anyone else can do, but then also have that aspect of your personality that they want, or that aspect of your like your feeling or your heart and what you put into things, I think is the key for me. And that's what I want. I want people to work with me because they want to work with me, not just because they need somebody to do their event.
Yeah.
You know, because there's a ton of people who do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that. You have to trust in your, mm-hmm. your being desirable.
Yeah. And that makes like selling yourself so much easier. I was like, oh man, having to do these calls where like you have to be like, this is why you should work with me. Like it sounds such a nightmare, but I know why I want people to work with me. Mm. And so I'm comfortable saying it. And if that's not a good fit, then it's not a good fit.
Right. You don't have to make up a reason.
Yeah.
According to the metrics, here's why you should.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it's really true that good people make good people. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, certainly there's weird kids who turn into monsters, but the way that you try to be in the world, mm-hmm. I imagine you would want your kids to be that
way. Absolutely, yeah.
But I also know a lot of your work exists on the internet, whether it's just connecting to people, the sort of marketing and promotional of a lot of the events you're affiliated mm-hmm. with are heavily, there's a lot of buildup and aftermath of conversations online where you can see the like most beautiful, vulnerable, best parts of people, and then also the sort of terrifying hellscape of yes. humanity.
Yep. The other 85% of
the internet. Yeah, yeah, as long as you're not cynical.
Right.
So I'm curious how you think about, even just like as a parent, your kids growing up in this world where you're modeling and wanting them to be like whole, vulnerable people who are building relationships. And then we have this sort of digital portal that can be a great way of making mm-hmm. those connections, but it also can be like I know you have a 3-year-old, so I'm guessing she's not on the phone right now, like
right.
Snapchatting or whatever. Yep. But
I don't think so. I mean, maybe.
But do you think both about how you want your kids to be in the world and how you are going to approach some of those aspects of the world as they're growing up?
I mean, it completely terrifies me. Like, I am more terrified of, you know, that kind of thing and just the absolute unknown of what that world is going to look like for them. Like, what privacy is going to look like for them, what the weather is going to look like for them, you know? It's like, there's so many things that I don't have a handle on, and so I feel like the best I can do with not knowing those things is trying to help shape a core outlook on life and how to work with people and how to engage with people and how to know what you think feels right or wrong and how... and what you want out of life, kind of thing. Like, have those questions, like, you know, teach them to question and teach them to help and those sorts of things. And, you know, that's, in a lot of ways, that's the best we can do right now because we don't know where those things are going to go. Like, I have all these, you know, we're on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter and all that kind of stuff. And I'm pretty conscious of, like, I don't use their names on Twitter, and I don't I don't really post photos of them on Facebook. I'll talk about them on Facebook, and I will post photos of them on Instagram, but I have my Instagram locked down. But it's like all these sort of like, they seem so arbitrary, mm-hmm. like delineations, because the fact of the matter is that I am putting photos of them on the internet.
And then what happens with them then?
Yeah, and I have thought a lot about the fact that they haven't given me permission.
Yeah.
And that feels weird.
And can they even? I mean...
Right. And so, obviously, right now, that doesn't seem like that big a deal because it's like, oh, it's this baby picture, right? But as things progress and things move on, have I taken that ability for them to live a private life away from them?
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so it's just like all these different, like, how do we, you know... how do we live in the technological world that we live in today? Like, it's hard enough for us as adults to, like, not want to just, like, throw it all into, you know, a flaming pit and go live in the woods.
Yeah.
But I just can't imagine, like...
I would die in half an hour.
Yeah.
We have to take... We'd take an Uber to the woods first.
Yeah. Yeah. Hopefully. And then you can still get, like, groceries delivered.
I think so.
Even though I don't have the technology to order it.
Yeah.
And so I think that that's, like, I try to... You know, of course, I'm still terrified of it, and so I don't know that... I don't want to give the impression that, like, that's, like, my zen outlook on it, but I...
But it also sounds like you're just sort of acknowledging I can't control that stuff.
Yeah.
But I... It's still, like...
Yeah, and, you know, there could be specific challenges that arise in that regard 2 years from now, and I can tackle those when they come.
Right.
But for right now, the best I can do is those pieces that I can control, and I'm really lucky that, you know, I had a... My parents were always very supportive and very engaged, and I never questioned, you know, their love for me or their support of what I did. And I just want to make sure that they feel that way too, because I know that that type of environment, you know, like you said, sort of influences my relationships with people today.
Yeah. Well, here's sort of maybe close to wrap-up question that I keep meaning to prep people for, and then I keep not... I should be like, hey, here's a thing to think about, and I'm like, nah, forget, maybe it happens. But if, can you think of a time when something didn't work out, how it was supposed to or you expected it to, and then either something good came out of it or something not good came out of it? The show is Pratfall's podcast, and so I like to get at some level of, like, this, I fell, but it turned into something great. But also, it can just stay not great, too.
Yeah. Man, I feel like that kind of thing happens every day.
Yeah. That's the joy of me not telling you to think about this, man.
Yeah. What if I cheat a little bit and just talk about failure?
That's fine with me.
I think about failure a lot, because I think that it's something that has a stigma attached to it that isn't a fair stigma. And I had never really been able to put that into, frame that properly. And I saw a speaker, his name is Scott Birkin, and, he did a talk about failure, and it was to and it was at an event apart. So it was, like, aimed towards designers and coders. I do a lot of design work, too. And he was like, every design project is just failure after failure. Like, and he had, like, a video of, like, a Photoshop background where it was just like, you put a box here, and then you're like, nope, it looks better over here. Nope, it looks better over here. Nope, here. And then we'll try this font. That doesn't work. We'll try this font. We'll put it down here. And it's like, that is, like, a bunch of failures right there. You tried this thing and it failed, and you knew it failed, so you moved it here. And he was saying that, like, it obviously those don't feel like failures because you have not put anything, you know, you're not really invested in those.
It's not emotional, yeah.
Yeah. But to try to look at failure in that same way, the larger failures in that same way, where, like, yeah, it hurts, and yeah, things did not go the way you wanted them to go, but you learned something out of each of those pieces. And from an events perspective, there's a lot of stuff that has gone wrong in my
events. I doubt anything ever looks the same at the last day as it did on paper that first.
No. But literally every time that one of those things goes wrong, I know how to handle it next time it happens.
Mm.
And so it's just like amassing this experience of how to handle situations. And that, in a lot of ways, is a key to success for being able to handle on-site, you know, things like that. And so you never know if you handle them correctly the first time, and then you're like, well, I think it maybe would have been better if I had done it this way.
Hmm.
And then you can try that the next time it happens, and eventually you sort of have your way of doing things. And so, yes, I will ruminate over the things that do not go well, and, you know, I will think more about those than the successes that I have. But at the end of the day, the thing that allows me to eventually move past those things is shaping them and putting them into to frame them as something that, well, next time that happens, I know what I'm going to do kind of situation. So, you know, I'm doing this big I started my own event with my friend Billy in Chicago. It's called the Chicago Cocktail Summit, and it's taking place next week. And we have been working on it for a long time, and there are a lot of things, now that we're coming down to the wire, that I know we'll do differently next time. Mm. And I think that if I had done this 3 years ago, I would, like, you would have come here and I would have been, like, in a fetal ball somewhere in this house, like, just kind of losing my mind and being like, this is all going to fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
And it may still, you know, but there are, like, I know that I have enough experience with these things where if X, Y, and Z does go wrong, I know how to handle it. And that's only just from going through it so many times. So.
Right.
And you're good at getting into a fetal ball if you've had enough
exactly.
practice.
Exactly. Right, yeah.
You even got that in your back pocket.
Yeah, it's perfect.
Ready to roll out.
Yep.
Well, that's amazing. Where should people go to find you, like your website, and then is there a social media thing?
Yeah,
they should try to get on Instagram to see your kids.
Yes, yep, and just try to say request follow, and then I'll just say no.
Right, but every day they
yep.
should come back and request
yep,
it again.
Just keep trying. I'll keep saying no, and then I'll block you.
Yep. And then they'll try to find you on another platform.
Yeah. They can come to my website, which is westraco.com. I named my company, like most good things, I think good ideas start as jokes, and yep. then they eventually...
If you look at any quality old email address, yeah, somebody had,
exactly.
it was some
so
weird reference.
I could not come up with a name for my company, and I was like, I'm going to call it Westra & Company, because it's just me, and that is funny.
Yeah.
And so that's why that is. So westraco.com, and that's actually just like my business site for any events or event-related things. And then I'm just Eric Westra on Twitter. And yeah, and you can see me at a bunch of different events in weird places all over the globe.
And you tweet about some of the things when you're
yeah.
at them, right?
Like yeah.
That's yeah.
As much as I can, yeah. I'm really excited. So I run events for a podcast company.
Yeah, Maximum Fun, right?
Yeah, Maximum yeah. Fun, yeah.
Who make so, awesome shows and do yeah. awesome events.
They're amazing. And that was another one of those things where Jesse Thorne, who runs Maximum Fun, and he's the host of Bullseye,
mm-hmm.
he was talking to somebody, my friend Dan Sinker, who I do the SourceCon with, and like literally he was at an event, they were there together, and it was 2 days after I quit my job. And he was like, I really need somebody to take over Max FunCon for us. But I don't want to hire a full-time employee. And Dan was like, call Eric tomorrow. And so, like, literally, I got a phone call from Jesse Thorne.
Nice.
And I was like, hey.
And were you already a listener to some of the shows?
The only one at that point that I was familiar with was Judge John Hodgman.
Mm-hmm.
But my wife listens to One Bad Mother.
Oh,
and,
yeah. It's a great show.
Yeah. They're all great. And so, you know, that worked out so well, and it's so much fun, and I get to, you know, hang out with like really smart people and comedians and go up, hang out in the mountains for 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really great. So we grew it this year. We're doing Max FunCon West and East, and we're sort of looking at working on some like mini Max FunCon day-long things in different cities.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see what happens with it, but that's a good one. What else can I plug for people? The Pratfalls podcast I heard is really good.
Yeah,
you
it's
guys
great.
Should check that out.
It's sort of racing yep. up the charts.
Yep. Yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks for talking to me, Eric. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks for. I don't know what that was.
Sounds like a dryer.
Yes. Thank you.
I'm keeping that ending. I'm turning this off now.